This is FMR.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, this program is important because it's designed to educate us a little bit on the run-up to the elections, this important election that we're having on the 29th of May. And in order to talk a little bit about it, I've invited Hugh Corder into the studio. Hugh is a law graduate of Cape Town, Cambridge and Oxford, and after starting his academic career lecturing at Stellenbosch University, he held the Chair of Public Law at the University of Cape Town and is now Professor Emeritus of Public Law. And he also served two terms as Dean of Law at UCT and in addition served as Interim Deputy Vice Chancellor in 2016 and 17 and elected a Fellow of the University of Cape Town in 2004. He's been active in many organizations in civil society since his student days in the 1970s, striving for the recognition of the rule of law and basic rights through the law in pursuit of dignity, equality, and freedom for all. He's written extensively in the field of constitutional and administrative law over the past 40 years, and then in 1993 served on the committee of drafting South Africa's first Bill of Rights, which became part of the transitional constitution. The ideal person to speak to, Hugh. Welcome indeed to Fine Music Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm a regular listener to
Well, there you are. Then you can stay.
Thank you.
So there are lots of things I do want to ask you, but perhaps let's just talk about your background, because I covered in a big way like that your career, but you've done all sorts of work, haven't you, by the sounds of things, both within and outside higher education?
Yes. I've reached the stage of my life when one reflects more often, unhealthily, on the era in which one has lived. I was born in the mid-1950s and have lived through what, from time to time, I think of being as one of the least unpleasant states of humanity in terms of development and not overdevelopment and tolerance, learning some of the never again lessons of the Second World War. But of course, growing up under apartheid and being acutely aware and becoming increasingly aware of injustice.
Even as a very young man?
As a very young man, a senior school scholar, one of my earliest memories is going to, after the death in detention of Imam Haron, there was an Anglican priest called Bernard Rankmore who fasted for 40 days at the Kramat on Signal Hill. And I remember going with members of the Social Responsibility Society at the school that I was at, which is Bishop's, to go and visit him. And that is one of the incidents that made a great impression on me. Probably the other greatest single set of meetings that I had was to go and work in King Williamstown with the Border Council of Churches in mid-1974. I was a second-year commerce student, and I went to go and help them prepare their financial books for audit. But the Border Council of Churches office was next to the office of the Black Community Programs, which was Steve Biko's band or organization that he founded, and he was there. And I was taken aside by this young man, not a whole lot older than I, and he asked me lots of questions about myself for about three quarters of an hour, and he just told me his name was Steve, and I had no way of connecting him, of course, with which I subsequently did, with who and how important he was, and that made a deep impression on me, particularly his killing in detention in September 1977.
And by all accounts, he was a very agreeable, interesting, intelligent man.
He was, and they tolerated me enormously, he and his friends, while they openly disobeyed their banning order by meeting with each other in full sight of the road and planning all sorts of things. But I had my student years at UCT from 73 to 77, and then I had this enormous privilege of doing postgraduate study in the United Kingdom at a very, very difficult time in the history of this country. Mm-hmm. But having had that, had absolutely no doubt whatsoever that I wanted to return to South Africa and try to plow back some of the privilege that I had enjoyed.
So did you decide fairly early on that you wanted to be go into law?
It was, I hate to say this, but almost a matter of trying to, not last resort, but try to cover as many options as possible. I did not want to be an engineer or a doctor or actually an accountant, but yes. Although I did a BCom law. My father was a much-loved and long-serving attorney in this town, never went to university, did the 5 years candidate attorney as a articles of clerkship. But the law increasingly fascinated me as I got through my 5 years at the University of Cape Town.
Was it fired a lot by your impression of what was happening in this country, by gross inequality, and did that fire you up to want to study law?
It did do so, and I was involved while being a student with founding one of the legal aid clinics at UCT, in fact at CAFTA in retreat, and I also got involved with a particular legal project for NUSAS, which was in a little bit of a resurgence at that point in the second half of the 70s. And I ran a national project for NUSAS in 1978, trying to stimulate more relevant legal education and to stimulate the creation of legal advice clinics at those campuses which did not have them.
So you were here in the country during the dreaded 80s as well.
Yes.
Where things really reached a head.
I returned in December 82. And there was no post available at UCT in the law faculty. I had a doctorate by that point, and it seemed to me the obvious thing to do to become a law teacher, although I'd never imagined so when I was a student, because I didn't have the most remarkable academic record.
Well, you became a doctor.
Good enough,
so.
But yeah. Good enough, but But Stellenbosch, remarkably, because I was the first ever Ikey to be employed at the Stellenbosch Law Faculty from 83 onwards, offered me a senior lectureship and gave me the greatest space to develop and respected the areas that I was interested in. I like to say this, that they allowed me to teach an optional course in the final year of the LLB called Marxism and the Law. It remains the only, at Stellenbosch in 1983,
of all places.
It remains the only course ever to be offered on that with that theme in this country. But I was, although the university leadership at the top level was extremely uncomfortable with me, the faculty backed me all the way, and I've been eternally grateful for that.
Hugh, let's have your first piece of music, a little break from legal talk at the moment, and you've chosen a hymn, Thine Be the Glory. Now, tell me why you've chosen this.
I've chosen that because it is, in my father's words in his will, a rousing Easter hymn, and he wanted a rousing Easter hymn to be played at his funeral, which was in 1997, and I always respond very positively to it.
Oh,
Here's a beautiful hymn sung by King's College, Cambridge, Thine Be the Glory. It was the first choice of my guests on this week's edition of People of Note, Professor Hugh Corder, who's Professor Emeritus of Public Law at UCT. And Hugh, we discussed your background and how you got into law in the first place. But as I suggested at the beginning, one of the things I'm keen to find out is how you became involved with the Constitution and the drafting process thereof.
Thank you. And I should just say one more thing about that piece of music, which has occurred to me now when you mentioned King's College, Cambridge. Every Christmas, we used to listen to the Nine Lessons and Carols on a long playing record.
Yes.
And sing along. So in my year that I was at Cambridge, I queued for hours and hours and hours to attend the Nine Lessons and Carols in December 1978, Christmas Eve. So that was a great moment.
Did you get in?
Yes, got in, queued from early in the morning, got in, and it was a fantastic experience.
I don't know if you know that these days, we broadcasted for a few years from King's College, and now Vox Cape Town with John Woodland and company record every year for us their Nine Lessons and Carols locally. And has a huge following because it's such a lovely process and story.
Yes.
And the lovely music that goes with it.
Yes.
But let's get back to
the Constitution.
The Constitution.
So one of the consequences of being at Stellenbosch University, I moved to UCT in the middle of 87 to the chair, which I then occupied to the end of 2019, the chair of public law. One of the consequences of being at Stellenbosch was that I was close friends with a number of people who went to Dakar to meet the ANC in the middle of 87. Subsequent to that, the idea arose, generated from the side of the ANC in exile, and particularly the Constitutional Committee, to meet predominantly with Afrikaans-speaking law academics in this country as part of the process of showing that the ANC members didn't have little horns sticking out of the top of their head and were prepared to talk and were incredibly capable of talking about the kind of fundamentals of a Western liberal democracy or more than that. And so I was involved in the planning of a really significant meeting which happened in late January 1989 in Harare. It was done under the guise of an academic conference convened by the then Dean of Law at the University of Zimbabwe. But it really was an opportunity for, I think, 24 of us, what we called passport-bearing South Africans, to meet with the ANC Constitutional Committee, plus others such as Thabo Mbeki was there, Steve Chwete, and others. And I'd gone up in September the previous year, 1988, with one colleague from Stellenbosch to plan that meeting, and I served on the steering committee of that conference. Two other occasions in the year, in July, in Oxfordshire, and then in Columbia University, New York, in October that year, again met with more members of the ANC in exile. And I tell this story only to explain why I think, because nobody's ever told me, that I was nominated to be on what was called a technical committee of four people, which worked from early May to November 1993 in drafting the Interim Bill of Rights. The way that the negotiations worked in 1993 in what was called the multi-party negotiating process.
Even though there were only four of you.
There were four of us.
On that actual committee, yes.
Yes. Yes. There were 27 delegations who were present there at the negotiations. And whenever they reached a sticking point, they would say, let's get technical expertise and help on this. It was a slight disguise. But it did, to the envy, I think, of a number of our colleagues, because there were two academics on that committee, put us into a position of influence, at least, because we made the proposals for what should be on the Bill of in the Interim Bill of Rights, and then the process was we appeared each time we issued a report before all the delegations, the negotiating delegations, to take questions and comment, and then they made more written comment and we produced other reports.
Were there people from the ANC as well?
Yes.
On this committee?
Yes. So effectively, somebody who subsequently became a Constitutional Court Justice, Zak Yacoob, was the ANC's nominee. There was a nominee from the Concerned South Africans group, which was the Conservative Afrikaans groups. They mischose their nominee because he was a card-carrying member of the ANC, Lawrence du Plessis, and there was a member of government, a civil servant, and then I was there. I don't know. I think I was the sort of the lowest common denominator upon whom everybody could agree.
Right. Okay. And to all intents and purposes, this was clearly a success because that's where the Bill of Rights ended up coming out of, as well as ultimately the Constitution.
Yeah. So I was in a very advantageous position because the year 1992 in Cape Town, a visiting Canadian academic, Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms dates to 1982, so only 10 years before, was on sabbatical in Cape Town. And he met with a group of eight of us, drawn from legal practice as well as the three universities in the Western Cape. And we drafted our own proposal for a Bill of Rights based on the Canadian model. So 5 months later, I went into the technical committee, and I already had the model of a Bill of Rights in place, and that is the model which our Bill of Rights follows today. But there are two rights in the Bill of Rights of which I'm especially pleased with there, and frankly, without being immodest, wouldn't have been there had I not been there.
Fair enough.
Something called the right of access to information, which stresses open governance, and secondly, the right to administrative justice, which is a right which can be invoked against or to keep the public administration accountable.
Okay. And clearly those are two very important things, so no wonder you're proud of something like that. Hugh, let's just break for a moment. There's so many questions I want to ask you for another piece of music. And I see we have here, well, Abdullah Ibrahim or Dolly Brand, when you asked for this particular recording of Mannenberg from 1974, when he was still Dolly Brand, wasn't he?
He was, and he played a concert in the what was then the Jamison Hall at UCT, I think in August 1976. It was definitely after the Soweto uprising, and it was coterminous with the troubles on the Cape Flats at that point among school children, etc., the uprising there. And he had been in sort of voluntary exile. He came back from, I think, New York, and he played the most remarkable concert. He said, I think, nothing throughout the whole concert. He walked in, he played his piano, including this composition, Mannenberg, and then he walked out. It was one of the most profound artistic performances that I've ever heard. I've heard him subsequently as Abdullah Ibrahim. Thank you.
1974-ish was when that was recorded, Mannenberg, with Abdullah Ibrahim. But before that, Dollar Brand. So he was Dollar Brand when he recorded that in 1974. And it was another choice of my guest here on People of Note on Fine Music Radio, Professor Hugh Corder, who's Professor Emeritus of Public Law at UCT. And with the election coming up, we're discussing the advent of the Constitution and rights of access, as was just discovered, to information and to administrative justice. But the other thing, apparently, Hugh, there's a lot of discussion about the courts, the judiciary at the moment in our constitutional democracy, including the Constitutional Court. Has anything changed there that you can enlighten us about?
Well, the most fundamental change between pre-94 and post-94 was the move from the what we call the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty, where, on a Westminster basis, to the institution of a constitutional democracy, where the top court in the country, in our case the Constitutional Court, which was the creation of the democratic South Africa, has the final say on the legality and the constitutionality of any exercise of public power or the performance of a public function. And when it was agreed upon at the negotiations in 93 that a constitutional court should be created, established as a new court, the jury was out on the extent to which it would be a success, and the existing court structures and judiciary to some extent resented the establishment of the Constitutional Court. But it has proved to be an extraordinary success overall. Most people would agree, I think, that the first 15 years of our democracy saw the Constitutional Court establish itself as a body enjoying great public legitimacy and also respect among the other two branches of government, the lawmakers in parliament and the law enforcers in the and policymakers in the executive. In the last 15 years, there have been a few hiccups, but overwhelmingly, I think the courts are a very strong feature and successful feature of the last 30 years in this country.
It's one of the things we can be very proud of, isn't it, our constitutional court, and the power that they have and the way they use that power, the fairness.
I think that what was critical was the tone was set by the first members of the court, of whom at least five or six of the 11 had been involved in what was often called struggle politics. So they had an acute sensitivity to how far they could get as a court, so that they resisted what is called in the language of the law overreaching. And so they kept resolutely to the language of the Constitution and enforcing it, but at the same time, they didn't exceed the envelope or whatever that.
What do they say? Push the envelope.
They didn't push the envelope unnecessarily. And overwhelmingly, it has to be said, the executive branch of government has complied with court orders. And that's a critical factor, because in many countries which pretend to be democracies, including one which is in the northern part of the North America, they don't always comply with the court orders.
Okay, but now also the government went through a phase in the last 15 years of not really liking the Constitutional Court very much, to put
yes.
it euphemistically.
Those whose conduct fall short of constitutionality or decent standards of ethical and honest government have regularly attacked the Constitutional Court when it has held them to the extraordinarily progressive and nuanced provisions of the Constitution.
Goodness me. Also, Hugh, the electoral system and the great significance of the changes about to happen in that system. For example, the accommodation of independent candidates for the first time at both national and provincial levels. This is quite would you call it a breakthrough?
It's certainly a breakthrough. The negotiators back in 1993, well, let me go one step back. An electoral system is absolutely critical, but it can be a complex beast. And we typically know two types of electoral system. One is what we had until 1994, the first past the post constituency system, which led, for example, in 1948 to the United Party getting 47% of the national vote and the National Party, the party of apartheid, getting 38% of the national vote. And they came into power with a majority of 5 or 6 seats because of the vagaries of the past first past the post constituency system. So when and given the difficulties and injustices created by group areas and spatial apartheid, clearly the constituency system wasn't going to work because it's also very complex to implement.
Okay, I see. But now I want to ask you so much more about this because I think it's very interesting with the election looming. But let's have another piece of music just to break the tension, so to speak, Hugh. And you've chosen Tracy Chapman.
Tracy Chapman's All That You Have Your Soul is, for me, one of the most beautiful songs that I have ever recorded, and I listen to it often. And the significance of it for me is the stressing of the spiritual and the that aspect of humanity. She's quoting her grandmother when she uses those words, and I am known to have sung it as part of a speech at the final year law dinner in Camps Bay in about 2013 or something.
My goodness,
like that.
Me, how brave
off
of
tune
you.
And incomplete.
She said she learned the hard way. Said she wanna spare the children. She said don't give a say your soul away, 'cause all that you have is your soul. So don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. I was a pretty young girl once. I had dreams, I had high hopes. Married a man who stole my heart away. Gave his love, but what a high price to pay. And all that you have is your soul. Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. Why was I such a young fool? Thought I'd make history, making babies was the best I could do. Thought I made something could be mine forever. Found out the hard way one can't possess another. And all that you have is your soul. Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. I thought I could find a way. Be the system, make a deal and have no debts to pay. Take it all, I take it all, I'd run away. Leave myself first class and first rate. All that you have is your soul. So don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. hunger only for the truth, 'cause all that you have is your soul. Here I am, I'm waiting for a better day, a second chance, a little luck to come my way. Hope to dream, I hope that I can sleep again, awake in a world with a clear conscience and clean hands. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat up a bit of fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. Oh, my mama told me, 'cause she said she learned the hard way. Say she wanna spare the children. She say don't give a say your soul away, 'cause all that you have is your soul. All that you have. All that you have. All that you have is your soul.
Tracy Chapman, that piece called All That You Have Is Your Soul. There you are, and that was another choice of my guest, Hugh Corder, Professor Hugh Corder, Professor Emeritus of Public Law at UCT. And actually, we've aimed this People of Note to be specifically relevant as we approach the election. So given, Hugh, that the first-past-the-post thing didn't really work here, what then was the alternative? Because the British Westminster system is first-past-the-post, isn't it? But we've got a new system has been created, or had to be created.
Yes. I think that the system of generally proportional representation is much more widely used in the world than first-past-the-post system, although many systems are mixed. So you've got to imagine that you're one of the negotiating parties or the chief negotiating parties, and you've just adopted the interim constitution, or you're about to do so in the second half of 1993, but there's going to be an election at the end of April 1994. How do you devise an electoral system? So the agreement was that for the first two elections, 1994 and 1999, there should be a proportional representation system on the basis of what it's called closed party lists. So each political party chooses its own people with no public input as to who should be on the list and where they should be on the list, both at the national level and at the provincial level. But even the interim constitution divided the up to 400 seats in parliament into two equal sections of 200 and 200. The first 200 being put together or composed, reflecting provincial ballot papers, and the second 200 reflecting where one puts one's cross, or the electorate does, on the national ballot paper. So since 1994, at the national and provincial levels, we've had two ballot papers. At the local government election level, which follow 2 years after each time, we've had two ballot papers, but there's been a space to vote for an independent or an individual human being as well as the party. So there's a combination at that local government level appropriately. Mm-hmm. Because one of the critical objectives of any electoral system must be accountability. You must know whom can you approach in order to say, I'm dissatisfied with what is going on in governance.
Well, now, this brings me to this idea of a three-ballot system, which we're going to have to deal with in this election. First of all, it always occurs to me that it's going to be cumbersome, isn't it? Or what are your thoughts on this three-ballot system?
I have, because I've been looking more closely as a result of the changes which are about to be implemented at the background to the system, it has impressed upon me even more the importance of the existence and the role of the Independent Electoral Commission, the IEC. Those who were around in 1994 might remember the incredible role that the IEC played Justice Johann Krichler.
Very much so.
A magnificent achievement to organize voting over a five-day period eventually, and then to produce a result which was more or less accurate and sufficiently fair and reflective of the wishes of the voters to be accepted by the vast majority.
And we had one voting paper then, didn't we? One ballot.
We, I think...
In 1994.
I think we... Did we not have a second one in provincial? I forget.
Okay.
But there may have been two, but there have been two at least since 1999. Okay. The final constitution said that Parliament should, after the 1999 election, devise a new electoral system, or at least review the electoral system. A number of committees, Fanzel Slabbert chaired one, and then later on Vali Musa chaired another, considered what changes we should make. The majority view, and that is the majority view in Parliament, after a critical judgment by the Constitutional Court, called the New Nation Judgment of 2020, the Constitutional Court decided that it was not constitutionally legitimate to confine representation in Parliament only to those appearing on a party list. This infringed unnecessarily on the right of freedom of association in particular, and that people should be allowed to stand as independents. Now we have the system which will be implemented fully this week, and it will confront each voter with three ballot papers. Many people I have encountered who profess ignorance on this matter.
That's a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because when you think of the vast number of people who are voting, many of whom are not really educated, as we know, is the third ballot paper only for independents?
No. And that's another nuance which might confuse people. One of them is the one we've always known, the national ballot paper with only the names of 52 parties. Appearing
yes.
on it. Not each, so that's at the national level. The provincial ballot paper will include the names of the parties vying for office within that province, so it will differ from province to province, plus those people who have qualified as independent candidates to sit in the provincial parliament.
I understand.
And the third ballot paper, which I'm calling the middle one, but is actually the primary ballot paper, where counting will start first, has been called the regional ballot paper. And there's quite a lot of intricacy around the regional ballot paper, so perhaps we should relax through listening to a little bit of music before
okay.
we get there.
Well, I'm going to rely on you, Hugh, to make it clear and not too complicated. But yep. Yes, let's listen. And it looks as though we're going to have the anthem by Leonard Cohen. Is there a specific reason you chose this?
Leonard Cohen has been, from my early days as a student, one of my closest friends, or my closest friend was a man called Stephen Watson, who was a professor of English and poetry at UCT. And we went for very long walks in the Cedarburg, just the two of us, days on end. And we used to sing Leonard Cohen songs. And Anthem has the extremely well-known line about ring the bells, it still can ring. It's a perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
The birds, they sing the break of day. Start again, I heard them say. Don't dwell on what has passed away, or what is yet to be. Yeah, the war, a holy dove, she will be cut again. Bought and sold and bought again. The dove is never free. Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. For signs, the signs were sent. The birth betrayed, the marriage spent. Yeah, the widowhood of every government. Signs for all to see. Say their prayers out loud. But they've summoned up a thundercloud. They're gonna hear from me. Ring the bell that still can ring. You can add up the parts, you won't have the sum. You can strike up the march, there is no drum. Every heart to love will come, but like a refugee. Ring the bell that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There is a thank you.
think that's a fairly famous song by Leonard Cohen, Anthem. And the fourth choice of my guest as we approach the end of People of Note this week, Professor Hugh Corder, who, as I've been saying, is Professor Emeritus of Public Law at UCT. And I did invite him in to help clarify some aspects of this election, of the constitutional process. And we're talking about the ballot papers, the third ballot paper. And I was rather surprised when you said how the third, which you sort of think is the least important, is actually quite important.
Yes. The third ballot paper, and I tend pictorially to put it in the middle, is called the regional ballot paper.
Right.
The regions coincide exactly with the boundaries of the nine provinces. But, and the parties which seek to be represented in the national parliament appear on the regional ballot paper, together with those independents who wish to serve in central parliament. So some independents want to serve in the provincial parliament, provincial legislature. Others wish to be elected to the national parliament. And in a sense, the counting will start with the regional ballot paper, because what the IEC will do, as I understand it, and perhaps after this somebody will intervene and correct
yes,
me,
okay,
because it's a new territory here, they will start by seeing how many votes have been cast on the regional ballot papers. They will then divide that by 200, because 200 seats
yes,
will emanate, if you like, from that regional ballot paper. And then that will produce a quota. And those independent candidates who've achieved that minimum quota will be elected to parliament. And then the rest of the seats out of the 200 will be allocated proportionately to the parties. Then the counting will move to the national ballot, and there it will follow relatively a different quota will arise, because the waters won't be muddied by the extent to which independent candidates have attracted votes to themselves. And that will then be determined. They're called compensatory seats in the Constitution. 200 seats will be divided among the political parties vying for the national ballot. And then the provincial parliament will be constituted in a sense on its own as a separate computing exercise.
You must admit, Hugh, that it is a little confusing.
It's confusing if one sits in the IEC. and I really take my hat off to the IEC. I am assured by those who know on the inside that they work incredibly hard and they generally do a really good job.
But for the people going to vote?
Well, the critical thing about the regional ballot is that one has a choice there between repeating one's vote or changing one's vote that one voted in the national or the regional or the provincial parliament, or choosing an independent candidate. So by voting for an independent, you can still vote for your party of choice in the province and your party of choice at national, but you can vote for an independent on the regional ballot.
The regional one, right.
Yeah.
And just as a last thought, because as always one runs out of time in radio, are you personally pleased about the fact that independents have been included now? Is that a good thing for our constitution?
I think it's a completely wonderful thing, provided that independents are not just a strong-minded individual, but yes, are grounded in the community and are there really as an individual representative of a much wider community. And there are those who are grounded in the community, and I see their role as being almost like that little grain of sand in the oyster that makes the pearl. Yeah. Or Helen Suzman's role in apartheid as a single member of the Progressive Party for all those years. They are troublemakers. Mm. They are there in order to agitate, to get the information, to ask hard questions, to serve on committees, and to speak out unrestrained by the party whip. And it can go wrong, and you don't want a whole bunch of too many independents, because that will become relatively ungovernable. But, you know, out of 400, up to 5 would be magnificent in my view.
Are you, I'm asking you this in your personal capacity now, are you confident about this election? Do you think It's, well, we all know it's going to be a very interesting election, but you also have great faith in the IEC, so you think it's going to work?
I think that from a logistical and mechanical point of view, it's going to work. What happens afterwards when the negotiations between the parties on coalitions or combinations of forces, that is anybody's guess.
Well, let's not go there. Let's end on a positive note. Hugh, it's been great talking to you, and thank you for elucidating so much about our constitution and also this election, the three ballot papers, the independents. And I've been talking to Professor Hugh Corder, who's Professor Emeritus of Public Law at UCT. Professor Hugh, thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you very much.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This is FMR.